This is KRFY 88.5 Ponderay.
This is 88.5 KRFY, community-supported public radio for North Idaho. Visit us online at krfy.org or on Facebook at KRFY.
Morning. Welcome to the morning show here on 88.5 KRFY. It's September 25th, Wednesday. I'm today's host, Chris Bessler, and we have a great show for you today. We kick off our local decision 2024 series of interviews with candidates. And today we're talking with the two candidates for Idaho Senate here in Legislative District 1. We have with us Dan Rose. Dan, thank you for being here.
Thanks for inviting me.
And Jim Woodward, the Republican. Jim, thank you for being here.
Good morning, Chris. Thank you.
And we're going to get into a good discussion of who you guys are, what you stand for, and hopefully we'll let the voters learn more about each of you and help them make their decision on which one you guys you want to vote for. It's going to be one of the two of you that end up being our state senator here. But first, I'm going to back up for just a second. We're going to take a look at the weather. And this might be like our last big summery type of day because it's going to hit a high of about 83 today. But we're going to see temperatures going down. There's a chance of showers at 5 o'clock or later. So that's going to be coming in. However, it's going to be sunny again on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, but the temperatures are going to be declining down into the higher 60s and the lower 70s. But it does look like a pretty sunny and nice, not quite as warm weekend coming up. And, of course, there's a lot of things going on around town. We're not going to get into the community calendar today. Maybe you'll circle around at the back end of the show. But for the moment, if you wanted to see all the things going on in town, go to our website, krfy.org, and click on the community calendars because, as usual, there's a ton of events happening over this next week. And with that, let's get back into today's conversation. Again, we have with us Dan Rose, the independent candidate for state Senate, and Jim Woodward, the Republican candidate. Thanks again to both of you for coming in. And Dan, you come first alphabetically, so we're going to start off with you. Why don't we start with a couple minutes, tell people about yourself and make any kind of opening statement that you like. I do like to ask why you're running as part of that. Yeah.
Okay. Good morning, Chris and LD1 voters. Today you'll hear positions on matters that might influence your vote, but most importantly, you'll hear information which impacts your lifestyle, principles, and cultural values. Though we share some commonality in military service, community service, and visions and values of LD1 voters, Jim and I differ in the execution of the legislative representation. My focus is on LD1 individuals, LD1 taxpayer, and the liberties we possess, which are under attack each legislative session at both the state and national level. By the Jim Woodward bureaucratic interests. What is not addressed in the questions and answers, I'll address in closing or on Facebook posts or at my website, which effective April 15th will have much more information.
Okay.
After all of the forums and stuff are done. I am a former BCRCC precinct committeeman for 8 years.
The Republican Central Committee.
Yeah. Republican Central Committee. Elected to both that and the PO Pendley Hospital District taxing district for 6 years, one term, 6 years. And I've been at numerous and countless hours of BOCC meetings. So I have a good understanding of what is going on in the district and a proven record of liberty conservative values.
Okay, well,
why you're running?
We got a little bit of time. Okay. Why you're running, and a little bit more on your pertinent professional experience that give you qualifications.
Yeah, I'm retired, a Massachusetts state trooper of 22 and a half years with military buyback time. I've served overseas in a veteran foreign wars on the demarcation line twice. I spent over 2,000 hours underwater, outside of a vessel, in the water, cold water, lack of visibility.
Scuba
water.
Diving, I take it.
Yeah, for the state police as underwater recovery. Mm. And I'm running as an insurance policy for the Liberty Conservative Voice, should Herndon have lost the primary race, which is exactly what happened.
Mm. Okay, thank you, Dan Rose. Jim Woodward, the Republican candidate for state senate, why don't you take a couple minutes to introduce yourself and touch on why you're running.
Good morning, Chris. Thanks. And thanks for everyone out here who's listening. I think most folks know by now, I grew up here. I have a pretty long history in Sandpoint and Bonner's Ferry. I'm also a business owner here in the town, involved in the community. I'm here running because I'm interested in preserving the Idaho that I grew up in. I think the Idaho that people move here to live in, that's the traditional values, traditional Idaho conservative values. We value our individual freedoms. We want as light a touch as possible with government. And I think in general, we call it a live and let live type atmosphere. So that, and by that, I mean that we do acknowledge that there are differences among us. And by keeping government as small as possible, we make fewer decisions through government and then are able to live in the way we want to, acknowledging our differences, but not forcing our beliefs upon one another. And so I think that is a liberty or freedom type approach to what we're after. I view the job of being the state senator, we're representing the community, representing individuals, and I'm out there doing that right now. I have served 4 years previously as a state senator, and so I've somewhat been asked and by many individuals already to take on some of the issues that varies from a drinking water system up north of Bonner's Ferry to other different constituent issues that are out there right now. So I'm actively working on those. My background, other than what I've said, that the 4 years in the Senate, I served in the United States Navy as a nuclear submarine officer. Since I've been back here, I've been on the Northern Lights Board for 10 years now. And in conjunction with that, Northern Lights, that electric co-op, is in a statewide association of all the other co-ops and municipal electric systems. And I serve on that board at the statewide level, here locally on the Sagal Fire District, and then involved in community activities all the time at different donated efforts, either up at Pine Street Woods, at Memorial Field. We try with my construction company that I own, we always take on at least one larger project every year. This year we tore down the house for Bonner Homeless Transitions in anticipation of a new project over there in South Sandpoint. So we don't just try to be a part of the community, we are a part of the community.
Okay, thank you, Jim Woodward. Well, back to you, Dan. The first question, actually, and this is probably the biggest part of our conversation today. Why don't you tell us what you consider the biggest issues in this race are, the things that you would think voters ought to be looking at, and as well, where you stand on those?
I'm not sure I have enough time to answer that question, but
we'll start off with just a couple minutes on that, okay?
Yeah, so I think taxes, education, public lands, and election integrity, Proposition 1, are all on my list of items to be discussed. I don't know if they're going to be discussed individually, but to answer each one of them in 3 minutes is not going to do justice to anybody. So I think those are at the head of my list. I would say there's also a change in leadership in the Senate happening with the pro tem leader having lost his primary election and other liberty movement successes coupled with incumbent losses on the Senate appear to be able to change the direction of the Senate's thinking from the past. That past thinking was challenged heavily by Senator Herndon, current senator, and in opposition to what Jim had represented in the 4 years prior to that. So I see that as moving in a positive direction for the liberty movement. And so I think those are the issues inside of the Senate construction of members. So on each one of those issues, I have much to offer.
Okay. Yeah, we are going to circle back on the specific issues that you rattled off there, taxes, education, and so on. But Jim, how about you? What are the biggest issues for you?
I think the big conversations in the next legislative session are going to, once again, we'll be back talking about school choice, and that's really a moniker for public funding for private education. And so I've been part of those conversations in the past. They continued in the 2 years that I was out of the state Senate. So we have to go back and take a look at that again, and we'll continue to have that conversation and see where the public really wants to be on. Or do we have to hold to our original concept of a public education system that ensures that all people get an education, and that those of us who want to have an education outside the public education system certainly have that right and that ability? Or do we want to veer away and really start to me, school choice becomes a question of, do we want to raise our own taxes? Because we in the education system, we acknowledge that it costs a certain number of dollars per child. And if we're going to add more students to the roles, if we're going to not only encompass the public education students in public education, but also those in private, then we're talking about a tax increase. So that's, I think that the school choice conversation eventually comes down to that. Are we willing to put more money in so that we educate students both inside and outside the public education system? So that's a big piece. There are other topics that will come up. I think that there will be a conversation about women's health care, where our abortion laws in Idaho right now are creating some challenges mm-hmm. with doctors leaving and proper care being provided.
That's actually a good one to come back to, because your couple of minutes is up there. But why don't we'll actually kind of go back and forth with who leads out on answering questions here. And a lot of things are related. You were talking about the education and financing. I do want to come back with a question on education, but let's circle back right now to the question of taxes. Idaho's tax system includes income tax, sales tax, property tax. It's kind of the three-legged stool there that our state revenues are derived from. Do you feel it's properly balanced? I know that a lot of folks that own property feel that property taxes are out of whack. And then the follow, you know, would you seek changes to our tax system? And Jim, why don't we start with you on that one?
Appreciate it. Yes, I subscribe to that three-legged stool of taxation, that we have all three: income tax, sales tax, and property tax. The property tax system we have set in place is not working well for us. I'd like to see some changes. The property tax is the one that is stable through ups and downs of the economy. So if you look back to 2009, 10, and 11, when we really saw a downturn, and the state parks, for example, or some of the other state services took a real reduction, and the education system, because they are funded by income tax and sales tax. Property tax, on the other hand, your trash was still getting collected because you're paying property tax for the local solid waste system. So some of these services we want, whether the economy is strong or not, and so we put those on property tax, and I think that needs to be an intentional decision. But the property tax system, the problem I see in it is that we shift the taxation between our four categories: residential, commercial, agricultural, and timber. Those are the four categories of property, and that the amount of taxation shifts between those categories based on values. And in the climate we're in northern Idaho, with the climb or the rise in residential property values that is so extraordinary, that means that the residential properties start to take on more and more of the tax burden. So that's the challenge, is to figure out how to get that equalized, how to get that, or more equitably distributed.
got an idea there?
I do, but it takes quite a while to go through.
Okay. All right. Well, then, Dan, the same question to you. Do you feel our tax system is properly balanced, and would you seek any changes?
Yeah, I don't see that it is properly balanced, and I would see changes. Jim's offered a solution relative to property value taxes as an average 10-year average in assessment and homeowner exemption increase. The homeowner exemption increase just shifts it to a different classification to either landowners or secondary homeowners, most of them from out of state, but they don't have exemptions attached to them. And so that is an unfair. The reduction in the income tax in the last legislative session was a sign in the right direction, or a move in the right direction. And the sales tax, has come down some. So I see the big one is the property tax. My proposal would be the institution of the CoStar commercial value system. It's a $5,000 per county cost. I think the state should bear that through a reimbursement. That would shift a long overdue corrective change to tax assessments between residential and commercial. It is commonly accepted that commercial does not pay a share because they don't have a proper estimate of those numbers to attach to the commercial. CoStar does that. Any homeowner exemption I would like to see attached to a Redfin.com homeowner market assessment, combined with shadow stat inflation numbers, as well as the government inflation numbers, which are differ with the shadow stats because government inflation numbers do not represent a lot of items that it used to in the past decades. I would also look at a trend in assessment to the downside in a year immediately after market devaluations, home sale devaluations. Right now we have a trend analysis that's accepted by the Idaho Tax Commission to the upward side every year, but you won't see a relative major change until your fifth year of physical property inspection. If you have that trend analysis to the downside the year after, that would cut out that waiting period between the physical assessment. So those are some of the issues that I see in the property tax.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I do want to say, if you guys want to follow up on any of these questions or a rebuttal, just let me know. We'll move on to another question if you're good on that with the tax question.
I would just like to add that Jim has recognized or admitted at a symposium, property tax symposium in the last month, that taxing is operating in an unconstitutional manner. But he's done nothing to change it in the 4 years he was there.
Jim, do you want to address that?
I believe what he's referring to is that we say we're going to treat all taxpayers equally. That's a constitutional requirement. We do have it, but then we do allow for some exceptions. And so my point that I was making there is that we used to have California's Prop 13. We have a Prop 1 that we had, but then was struck down. So we talked about, or we did try to put in place a system for folks who lived in their house not to get taxed out of their house, and that was struck down. Right now, the exemptions that are in place are authorized under Idaho law and Idaho Constitution, my comment might have been that we're providing exemptions, and so we ought to consider that. And I have worked, I worked 2 years on an interim committee for property taxes, looking at how to solve some of these problems. And that was back when we had a couple different tax committee chairs. And we made a little bit of progress while I was there. We did raise the homeowner's exemption from $100,000 per year, or $100,000 of assessed value, to $125,000. That's still not kept up. It would be my intent that we get the homeowner's exemption back to essentially 50% of median home value. That's what, when the homeowner's exemption first went in, that was where it fell.
So. Okay, thank you. Dan, do you get a minute if you want to keep on that one? Okay, all right. So I do want to circle back on education because it is kind of tied into to taxing here. And Jim, we'll start with you. You did already mention that education's one of your priority issues. But Idaho for many years has been in the very bottom among the 50 states in funding education. And this past legislative session, Governor Brad Little proposed and the legislature approved a bill that sweeping legislation, really, under which Idaho will spend an additional $1.5 billion over the next decade to help fund building construction and maintenance for schools around the state. Would you have supported or opposed this bill had you been in office? And I guess my follow-up question was, you kind of touched on, you know, private funding. You know, what's your stand on vouchers, which would be used to help parents that want to send their kids to private schools, but might take away money from public schools?
Well, let's start with going back to our Constitution, which says that we're going to provide a free, thorough, common system of common schools for the education of our children. So that's the baseline that we've agreed we're going to do that. And so what we have done for many decades in Idaho, or our history, has always said that the state would then provide the operational funding, and then the facilities would be constructed at the local level. This House Bill 521 that passed this year that provides that $1.5 billion is a significant paradigm shift for the state of Idaho, that the state would provide money for funding of the school facilities, not just the operations. And so that House bill sets aside some of your sales tax dollars. I think it's $125 million are dedicated now per year to support payments on this, the bond line that's going to be issued and is happening right now. And that money is going to be distributed out to all the school districts across the state. We're going to see a significant amount of money come in to both Lake Pend'Oreille School District, West Bonner School District, and Boundary County School District. So that I think it is a good step forward. And yes, I would have supported House Bill 521 to provide that funding. And that money can be received in payments or one time. I think that our schools are looking at taking that money when it's available, and they're going to... In Boundary County, I think the intention is to replace the Valley View Elementary School, and this will pay for some portion of that. So not all of that school. The project here at Lake Pend'Oreille School District, I can't remember right now, but you know, I've seen that list of what the items are. And so there will be some significant improvements to our facilities here, and so I'm very supportive of that. Mm-hmm. And then to answer your question about the school vouchers, I'm back to what I said. I want to represent the community, and we'll see where the community is. But we have to acknowledge that if we're going to pay for more children, pay for the education of more children, those who are in the public education system and those who are not in, then that's going to cost more. But I have supported in the past, and you'll see it on my voting record, some of the programs we put in place that support children who are being educated outside the public school system currently, and that is the Empowering Parents Program, and along with the programs that go on in our school districts here, where our school districts are already providing the ability for students to come in, participate in extracurricular activities or part of the curricular activities, but not be a full-time student. So we have a good mix. We're supporting everybody and however they want to reach their goals. We also have the Idaho Digital Learning Academy, so students can homeschool but with a curriculum. So there is school choice in Idaho.
Okay, thank you. Dan, same question back to you. Would you have approved or voted for the $1.5 billion that was approved by the legislature in the last session? And you know, what's your posture on school funding generally, and also speak to the voucher question?
Yeah, so the Constitution states that we're to fund K through 12. With the launch program extending beyond 12, seeking education of industrial or how do we say vocational skills other than college. This state has opened the door to private funding of students outside of the public school system. Currently, we have one operating private school and two more to come online between here and Boundary County in 2025. That's a potential 250 students being taken out of the public school system. And that will increase year to year because those three entities are starting at K through six. And each year they're adding a seventh, eighth, ninth, 10th grade. So over the next 6 years, that number of 240 will increase to somewhere around 500. I see that as a great opportunity for outside of public school. It creates competition for the public school, private school education. I would have voted in favor of HB 521, and I would have voted in favor of 2023 Bill H242. Both of them provide a transitional change of state funding towards the schooling system. I've done some document requests, and I've found that the Bonner County City Building employees make about $28 an hour on average. Bonner County Sheriff's Office makes about 32, and LPOSD makes about 40 per hour. And that does not include summer earnings for the LPOSD. I don't believe the performance metric measurement shows convincing evidence that more money thrown at schools does a better job. I've coached youth sports for the better part of 10 years. I know how to reach children both from a verbal, written, and physical tactile type of teaching instruction. I had a 504. My son was a 504 student in Massachusetts, which is a learning disability. He only needed extra time taking tests. But I do see with the current desires at the State Board of Education level an increase in evaluation of learning disadvantaged children, that the move will be to create a greater ADA amount of funding for public school students to classify them as learning disadvantaged, which I see as very, how do we say, problematic issue if it's being used for revenue generation as opposed to learning. I am in support of vouchers, a $6,000 voucher for a student that falls a student, or a tax exemption in a level equivalent to the ADA funding amount.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'll come back on and talk to you on a few things there, Chris.
Okay.
So first, the Constitution does require a K-12 system, but it does not restrict other programs that we want to take on. And the launch program right now, you can see what that's doing for us. We're in a position in Idaho and the country, in Idaho, two things contributing. One, we've become a tourism-based economy, and it's hard for young families to live here, so we have a shortage of workers in the trades. And then second, we have a demographic shift as the baby boomers age out of the workforce. So what do we sit back and just complain about it, or do we figure out how to get some people in the trades working? And that's what the launch program does. Do you need someone at a nurse, a plumber, an electrician? Do you think you're having a hard time getting an appointment or a contractor? Yes, then let's figure out how to solve that problem. So that's what we're doing. We talk about public school counts. We do have some private schools opening up, and most of the time what you're seeing is that people who are students who are homeschooling now are shifting into those programs. So that's great. Let's support those. But it's not taking the count out of the public schools is not going down. We're just bringing more people into those some of those opportunities that we're providing. If you look at Boundary County, they put up 100 openings try to start with a little bit of a pilot or to open a program to support homeschool, and they filled up immediately. Mm. And so they'll expand that as they have the ability. Want to step to a different subject a little bit, and we talk about funding for the schools. Last year, we saw that the Idaho State Superintendent of Public Instruction, Debbie Critchfield, introduced a bill that would was a pilot program to fund for performance, because our public schools have room for improvement. And that was shot down by Herndon and the likes. So if we're going to talk about wanting more for our more bang for our buck, then let's support it when the effort is put forth.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Dan, you get another couple of minutes on that topic.
Yeah, so in Boundary, that program might exist, but in 2025, the Hinsdale Charter School is coming online, and that will be 120 kids for K through 6, increasing 20 students probably each year thereafter. And that is a competition of educational system against the public schools. I do believe public schools will see a loss of children, and that means they'll receive a loss of ADA funding as well. And they'll look for ways to get that back. And I generally think that those charter schools and private schools will be subject to funding, because the state legislature has approved and funded the launch program for vocational interests. And the problem I have with that is, one, it's beyond 12th grade, and secondly, it is the government picking winners and losers on who and where those people will go get that vocational education. It's not an open system. It's not like a kid picks to go to a school. The government's picking the industry, and they're picking the businesses in those industry to do the training. To me, that's a bad combination.
They're not picking specific businesses. They're providing an opportunity for young people to look at careers. And like, we have students going right here from Bonner County going down and becoming mechanics or welders, going to NIC, and then they're in an open market for a job wherever where there is demand.
Okay. Well, thanks for those responses on that one. Let's turn to a new topic here, and I'll go first with you, Jim, on public lands, because our public lands, there are some folks that would like to see some of our public lands transferred into private ownership. And where do you stand on that? And do you identify issues with management of our public lands?
So I don't agree. I do not agree with shifting our public lands into private ownership at all. The reason we live here is because we have the ability. Many people live here and enjoy what we the opportunities we have to be out in the forests, wherever they are in these public lands. And so to transfer away from that would be shifting away from our culture here in Idaho. Now, do I think that they're all of our lands are managed perfectly? Not at all. So what we have done in the past, or what we're doing now, is starting to help manage those federal lands at a more local level, because we understand the problems better. It is harder to work with the federal government, just because it's more detached from us. I've always advocated for local decision making. So one example of that, the program we have called the Good Neighbor Authority, that allows the Idaho Department of Lands, a state agency, to buy a timber sale and conduct a timber sale on federal ground, that's been successful for us. It's allowed us to manage some of these timber grounds. We know we were fortunate this summer that we didn't live in the smoke, but much of the western United States did, because we haven't managed our grounds as well as we could have over the last four decades. So supportive of local management of those lands. They're owned by the United States government, but that doesn't mean that we can't work with that and manage those grounds here.
Okay, thank you. Dan Rose, same question to you. Do you support public lands? Would you like to see them transferred to private ownership? And do you see issues with the management of our public lands?
Yeah, I would say that constitutionally, state of Idaho is at a disadvantage to many other states who don't have such a large possession of U.S. government-owned land. I would like to see them managed locally. I think that the Good Neighbor Act, I was for originally, but what that program does is it allows the timber sales profits to be plowed back into the federal lands for management. It does not come to general fund for counties. I had reached out to Idaho Department of Lands, And the Good Neighbor Authority has two operating land management issues between in LD1. One's in Boundary County, one's out in the west part of Bonner County. In the contract agreements for that Good Neighbor Authority, the state is seceding to subordinate interest, and any attempt to get federal lands back because of those Good Neighbor Authorities is going to severely hamper that process, because we are admitting through those contracts that the U.S. government is superior to the inferior position of the state of Idaho. So I would like to see those properties move into the state of Idaho possession. If they get transferred to private hands, it would be through the auction process, which allows that money to go for funding of education. So I do see, or would like to see, a movement towards owning more of the federal land, with the response to that being that we manage it, and if it gets into private hands, it would benefit the schools as well.
I think we need to be realistic in our expectations. 50 states own that land, those federal lands right now. One state would like to have them. So we'll, if you think about the vote in the U.S. Congress, how that's going to go, pretty slim chances that we're going to hand that back over to the state of Idaho. Dan raises a point about the Good Neighbor Authority, that right now the money that being generated by those timber sales is not coming back to our schools as it did in the past. We used 25% of timber sale proceeds on federal ground used to come in the schools and the road and bridge department.
As a payment in lieu of taxes.
Exactly. And there, so there is a payment in lieu of taxes system. There's a secure rural schools program, but also just the federal timber sales, the proceeds from those came to the county and the school district. And so there's a problem there. I recognize it, and I've been actively working on it. I was working on it when I was in the state Senate prior. I'm in conversations right now with a number of folks that we it's time to change the parameters on the Good Neighbor Authority, because when we first started that program, there was investment made in getting that program up and off the ground. And with the conversation that once there was enough operating capital there, enough money to in that pool to continue to run the program, that then the timber sale proceeds would start to flow back out of it. So it's time to make that happen.
Mm-hmm. Dan, you want any more time on that one?
Yeah, PILT has increased up to $38 million, I believe it is, from 32 in recent times. So PILT is coming up a little, but it's not nearly enough to address the changes that used to come from those monies. Good Neighbor Authority is a contract between the state and federal at this point in time. They're working on trying to get that contract available to be between the state and the counties, which at the moment the counties do not have direct negotiating access to the federal government. They say it's in the process of getting moved towards counties, but the state right now is the other party with the federal government in that Good Neighbor Authority.
Okay. Thank you both for that. Actually, I'd like to circle back on a healthcare question, as Jim brought that up as an issue. So the institution of the abortion ban in Idaho without exceptions for pregnant patients' health has been cited as a reason that a BGH can discontinue the obstetrical care because doctors feel they could change criminal charges. It's kind of interesting that just yesterday, an OBGYN that formerly lived here, named Amelia Huntsberger, and she testified before the Federal Senate Finance Committee, which was having a hearing on this matter of healthcare issues, especially in our kind of rural communities, that she ended up leaving Sandpoint after she'd practiced here for 11 years because the abortion restrictions were threaten potential sanctions against doctors. So I'll start with you on this one, Dan. Do you see a need to address this?
I believe Abortion Bill 2023, number 4, House Bill 476, addressed this issue quite clearly. It took away penalties for abortion advice and practice. It's clear to me that in a good faith effort of the situation, that the doctors are not being held liable. One, I do not agree with the ability to take licenses away from a doctor. I believe that if there is a violation of that 476 bill, then it would be a financial one only, increasing in severity with multiple occurrences of the violation. But 476 addresses that's what she's saying is an embellishment of the facts. Being with POHD for 6 years and seeing that the Pohnerie Health District, whose three main functions were women's health, which is the abortion and birthing issue, and mental health and ENT. They stated that they would not be able to get a behavioral health psychiatrist into this hospital area because of the salary levels being too high. A couple months later, they turned around and hired a psychiatrist and fit that bill. We can find doctors that will come here for birthing and abortion that do not necessarily have a political axe to grind and will operate in a manner within the law, and they will not be held criminally liable for doing so as long as they're operating within the constraints of the law. So though she might have been here 11 years, this seems to me, from my experience, I can tell you that the increase in the Sandpoint Women's Health for birthing did increase year over year. The number of patients had not gone down when I left in 2023. So there is no shortage of patients or births. I just don't think the hospital could handle the expenses because of their operational policies. And Kootenai has a better access to that and is now providing that in BGH's absence.
Okay. Jim, same question back to you. Do you see a need to address the abortion ban in Idaho, particularly as reflects the fact that doctors seem to be leaving because of that?
Yeah, that's just the point I'd like to make, Chris. I think that, yes, I see a need to address it because there is a problem. Our doctors are not comfortable working in the state of Idaho, and so a number of them are leaving. The number I was told is that since the Roe v. Wade was the status of that was changed, that 20%, 2% of our OBGYNs in the state of Idaho have left. So we will get ourselves in a position where you can't get adequate medical care in the state of Idaho. Dan was addressing a bill in 2023 that covered some very specific instances. So I think this comes down to, do you trust your doctor? That's what we do when we go to a doctor, because they are a medical expert. We don't go to the doctor because we think we just need to be at a doctor to have something done. We go in because we don't know what we have a medical question, whether it's abortion or anything. When we go to visit the doctor, we go in to talk to an expert who understands our bodies better than we do. So do you trust your doctor? And so do we write the legislation and our Idaho laws to reflect that doctors can make judgment calls? I have conversations at a minimum weekly, almost daily, because I've really been trying to have a better understanding of where we need to be. I talk to doctors who are not from here. I talk to doctors who are practicing in Idaho or doctors who have been practicing. Had a conversation just last week with a prominent emergency room physician. There are decisions that have to be made, and when you're making the decision in an emergency room, and your first thought is, do I need to call my attorney to figure out if this is legal or not, instead of what do I need to do to stabilize this patient, that's a problem. And that's what we have to get everybody back in the room and figure out how to set this policy in place. I don't personally believe in elective abortions, and that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about taking care of a patient who, you know, the one that was dealt with in 23 was the ectopic pregnancy situation. But there's more than just that, and that's why I say, do you trust your doctor?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we are down now to just not too much time. I'm going to squeeze in one more question, and then we're going to go to give you guys a chance to make a closing statement each. And this is on Proposition 1. It's the Open Primaries Initiative. It's going to be on the ballot in November. This proposition, if approved, would end Idaho's closed Republican primary so that all voters, regardless of party affiliation, could vote in the primary election, and would also allow voters to rank candidates in order of preference. Do you support or oppose Proposition 1? And I guess that would come to you first, Jim, on this one.
Sure. I would like to go back to what we had for many, many decades in the state of Idaho, which is an open primary. It's just been since 2010 or 2012 that the primary was closed. I think what we're doing is narrowing down the voter pool. We have in the state of Idaho about 1 million registered voters. Of those, 278,000 are unaffiliated. And if you go into the primary election in May and ask for an unaffiliated ballot, you get an empty piece of paper. And so we're excluding those people from the election process. So we need to bring back everybody, because if we want to find a candidate who represents all of the people, then we have to have all the people voting. I know there's some consternation over the ranked choice voting. Open to having a conversation with people about that, but we need to have an open primary.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Dan Rose, same question to you. Support or oppose Proposition 1, the Open Primaries Initiative?
I oppose Proposition 1 greatly. It is designed to set up a system where you vote in the primary. And the process by which that happens is a watered down version. In the primary, if as it currently exists, you want to have the most conservative voice being represented, which would be mine in this race, then you would want to be able to choose on that straight up. By introducing more parties to that open process, you are watering down, and you end up with multiple votes on the same ballot. What comes out of it, that is a middle-of-the-road candidate. So the Republican Party isn't really picking their conservative voice. They're, how do we say, in the open process, allowing Democrats, who now cross parties, to affect what candidate shows up on the general ballot. So in that sense, if you have an open ballot, you end up with two neutral or mediocre conservatives on a general ballot, and I oppose that greatly. When you, as an independent candidate, I know.
Yeah, I was going to try to interject that question. You are an independent.
Correct.
So you didn't have much to vote on in the primary.
I wasn't on any ballot.
But you couldn't cast a vote in any of the primaries.
Yes, and when you go into the booth, it's not like you have an empty ballot. As an independent candidate, unenrolled voter, you get to choose between a Democrat ballot, Republican ballot, Constitutional ballot, or Libertarian ballot. You have that option on election day as that independent unenrolled candidate to pick one of those other ballots. So it's not true that you have to go with the independent ballot, which usually just has judges on it. You can pick a Republican ballot if you wanted to. You wouldn't be able to do that under this Prop 1 passing.
Independent is different than unaffiliated, but what I think I just heard is that maybe he voted in the Republican primary, and so he's not truly an independent candidate.
I didn't vote in the Republican primary. I was independent, and I couldn't vote. I didn't have...
Unaffiliated or independent?
I'm an independent candidate in an unaffiliated party. I didn't go in and choose a Republican ballot.
To have chosen the Republican ballot.
But I could have.
You would have to have declared as a Republican and signed up as a Republican.
Correct, and that would have knocked me out of the independent candidate race.
So what you just said is you cannot be a Republican. A second ago you said you can choose to vote, but you just told us you can't.
No, as an independent voter, you can pick any ballot you want. As an independent candidate, if I went in and picked the Republican ballot, I would now be throwing myself out of the independent race as a candidate. So, because I would get changed back to Republican, and that would knock me out of eligibility to run as an independent candidate.
Okay. I thought there was a requirement that you had to register as a Republican well in advance of Election Day, but
that's if you're a member of another one of those parties.
Oh,
if you're an independent,
you have to become unaffiliated. Yeah,
if you are unaffiliated,
right?
Yeah, unaffiliated you can pick as a voting status, independent as a party status.
Okay, all right. Well, we're at that time now that I'd like to go to basically closing statements. Dan, you get to go first. Give us a minute or 2 minutes. Tell us a little bit about why folks should vote for you.
Okay. I am the Liberty Conservative candidate. I am not the bureaucratic Boise candidate. I believe in the Constitution and the provisions provided by the Constitution. I have affected change here in Bonner County in the oath of offices that the county elected officers take to exclude Ann Laws as part of the oath. I think it's quite clear that the legislature and the constitutional creators stated that they wanted the oath to be the U.S. and the Idaho constitutions only. I have affected that change with another individual. I propose an update of the grocery tax, which we haven't talked about, which Jim does not seem to be able to recognize, at least according to his own website. He's asking for advice on where it should be. I have, and I can read it to you if you like. I have conducted a layman study of the matter, and $125 grocery tax is woefully insufficient. Jim states that he wants the $19,000 to $25,000 in out-of-state revenue from the grocery sales tax to remain in place, because there is no tax he likes to get rid of. But in that same process, giving us $125 back per person, the taxpayer is not being made whole, and the representation that amount of money is the sufficient amount is a lie to the public. That number should be between $180 and $200 per person, and I have the receipts to prove it. Again, we discussed those other issues. I would propose implementation of a state bank under certain conditions that might be happening at the national level. I'm against CBDC as economic slavery, and it violates constitutional articles as well. And I believe Representative Scott's recent Bill 417 about cash payments goes towards that issue. I would propose that legal immigrants be handed back over to ICE DHS for deportation. I would ensure that public dollars not be issued to any municipal works project for which hires illegal immigrants. That's a constitutional concept. I agree for HTO water rights for agriculture that's being challenged in the South by mining.
And last one, we're just about out of time.
I'm for the issues of gun ownership and carrying, as long as they are in a safe manner, and specifically the ones towards schools, as long as that gun is locked up during the school day, whether it's in a closet or the desk, and the kids can't get access to it, and it can only be accessed in short time for the immediate need of a problematic situation. It would be available just as it is to any individual outside the school system.
Okay. Thank you, Dan Rose. How can people find out more about your campaign?
They can reach me at Facebook, Dan Rose, Rose for Idaho. They can reach me, my website has a contact page at roseforidaho.com, and my email is roseforidaho@gmail.com.
Okay. Dan Rose, a Republican candidate for Idaho Senate. Thank you. Dan Rose, independent candidate. Jim Woodward, Republican candidate, can you give us your closing statement? You actually have 3 minutes if you want them.
Thanks, Chris. Just to quickly address the grocery sales tax, yes, you can look on my website and you'll see that a few years ago I wrote an article and I asked people for their opinions because I believe in representing the community. I got a lot of valuable feedback from that, people from all across the state even, because that article was published statewide, shared a lot of information. And you'll see that when I served as state senator, we did raise the grocery sales tax credit while I was in office, and I've long advocated that we continue to raise that. It's a big push. Dan hasn't served in the state senate to understand the processes there or what it takes to get the majority of 70 representatives and 35 senators and then the governor to sign something to put it into law. So I will push for a grocery sales tax increase. We'll continue to work on that. But I do advocate that we keep the grocery sales tax in place at the cash register with the credit and then return that money to Idaho residents at the end of the year, because it's in the millions of dollars. He misspoke and said $19,000. It's on the order of $19 million, we think. We don't track all those sales individually between non-residents and residents. But when people come into the state of Idaho, use the roads, use the emergency services, any of the other services that are being provided, we hope to have them help pay for that because they're here using those services. I am running for state senate again. I served 4 years and really appreciated the opportunity. I work for the community. I'm still a business owner here. I understand what it means that you have to get the job done. I always say you have to get the job done if you want to write an invoice as a business owner. And it's the same thing if you're not getting the work done as a state representative or state senator, then you don't belong there. I've not been on the sidelines instigating problems. You won't find videos of me rough and tumble with other folks in the community. You're not going to see me at the county commissioners holding up decision making. You won't see me at the hospital board causing problems. I'm out there trying to solve problems, not make problems. I think that means that we work together. And again, keep that. What we do through government as light as possible, because we know that there are differences in ideologies and thoughts about how we should live. And so the more decisions we get to make as an individual, the happier we'll be in our own lives. So let's leave the decision making at the local level or the individual level. I'm ready to get back down there and go to work. But like I said, I actually am working right now on about six different issues. And so we'll continue to do that job. I appreciate the opportunity.
And Jim, how can people find out more about your campaign?
Our website is Jim Woodward for Senate, FOR, Jim Woodward for Senate, .org or .com.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. Well, I want to say thank you again to Dan Rose, independent candidate, and Jim Woodward, Republican candidate for Idaho State Senate. We've had a great conversation. I think voters will learn a lot by listening to this. If you did not catch the entire show, you will be able to hear the recorded podcast on our website, krfy.org. It probably will be late today before we get that posted, and then it'll be there permanently after that, so you can circle back on that. And that's what we have for you today, folks. If you'll be tuning in every Wednesday, we are going to be continuing the election coverage that we have here every year. And we are focusing on the state legislative races, so we will be talking to House candidates next week. I haven't nailed down which pair it's going to be just yet, but please do come back these next several Wednesdays as we come up to the November 5th election day in order to learn more about these candidates that are running for office. And I do want to say thank both you guys just for putting yourselves out there. It's really important to the whole process that we have good races that where we have people that are airing these different ideas, because that's how we arrive at the best solution forward, I like to think. So again, thanks, Dan, and thanks, Jim.
Thank you, Chris.
And with that, we're going to go out with a Beatles song, Here Comes the Sun, because when I got up this morning, I saw a beautiful sunrise. So that's what we have for you, folks. Bye now.
Must have get. Here comes the sun.
something, I say it's all right.
This is KRFY 88.5 Ponderay.
This is Bird Note. The house sparrow, introduced to North America from Europe in the mid-1800s, has spread across the continent and can be seen grabbing French fries off the sidewalk from coast to coast. They often compete with native species for nesting sites. In the 1870s, another European sparrow came to the U.S., but had a completely different fate. In Lafayette Park in St. Louis, Missouri, a dozen or so Eurasian tree sparrows from Germany were released. Their descendants fanned out across the city and its suburbs. Eventually, some moved up the Mississippi River to Illinois and southeastern Iowa. But that's about as far as they traveled. Unlike house sparrows, Eurasian tree sparrows haven't become invasive in North America. It's not fully clear why, but it's possible that they just behave differently, and the aggressive house sparrow may have helped prevent the tree sparrows from spreading further by competing for the same nesting sites. Eurasian tree sparrows still remain in a small area of the Midwest, where they're not much of a nuisance to native birds and are a local curiosity for birders. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Remmel. Did you know you can listen to Bird Note in your podcast app? Subscribe to Bird Note Daily and never miss an episode.